exodus are haunting them. Based on official estimates, India is home to some 40,000 Rohingya refugees, but independent reports put the figures at hundreds of thousands.
Most of the refugees I spoke with feared that their identity would be disclosed, given the high risk of detention. Scores have also gone into hiding at undisclosed locations across India. They have a horrific tales of separation from their families amid a persistent deportation campaign and an intensified crackdown against the community. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
Heads of NGOs in Syria have gathered to loudly voice an urgent need for help. In Damascus, more than 550 NGOs read out a statement before media outlets calling on the U.S. to lift its unilateral economic sanctions on Syria, explaining the years-long siege deprived Syria from its basic needs and equipment needed to rescue those affected by the deadly earthquake.
Today, I apologize to the victims who we heard their voices under the rubble but could not help. Our volunteers were hearing them but couldn't save them because we do not have necessary equipment. 12 years of sanctions left us without required vehicles and rescue equipment. Many people died under the rubble because of those sanctions.
Speakers say the recent ease of U.S. sanctions on Syria to help humanitarian aid reach the country is not effective. That's because banks, companies, and governments around the world are still reluctant to engage with Syria, as they might face legal obstacles in the future. Western states claim that food and medicine is not included in their list of sanctions, but the reality is vastly different.
Sanctions have affected my life, my neighbors, and all Syrian people. We don't have fuel or electricity, and this has raised prices of everything like food and medicine. This is unbearable, especially after the earthquake.
We all here came to say lift economic sanctions. This country cannot stand any more suffering. Even before the earthquake, we were collapsing economically. Those sanctions are only affecting the ordinary people, not the government.
Here, rescue workers are in a battle against time. The death toll keeps rising, and those who could get away from the earthquake are now struggling to survive with a lack of food and shelter. Syrians say it's about time the U.S. and its Western allies end the economic siege that has caused enormous pain and suffering for innocent citizens. They ask for a just and fair world where humanity comes first before all political agendas. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
We're used to the revolving door of Westminster politics with prime ministers coming and going at dizzying speed. North of the border, things have been much more stable for many years, until this week.
In my head and in my heart, I know that time is now, that it is right for me, for my party, and for the country. And so today I am announcing my intention to step down as First Minister and leader of my party.
Speculation is rife about why she quit, such as the impact of the pandemic and the UK's top court ruling last year against Scottish Government's ability to hold a second independent referendum without approval from the British Parliament. But there's one reason that stands out the most.
Her undoing was brought about by the very controversial GRR bill, which would have given people the ability to change their gender after 3 months without a medical certificate. This outraged many feminist groups in Scotland, and it was passed with a big majority in the Scottish Parliament, but was immediately blocked by the Westminster Parliament.
Sturgeon's resignation has also raised the important question of what will happen to Scotland's independence aspirations in her absence from frontline politics. After all, she was the architect of the referendum in 2014 and has pushed for a second one since the first didn't get a majority vote.
The majority of Scots do want independence. This stepping down of the First Minister will be seen as a setback, but it's not a major setback.
With that in mind, a lot will depend on who emerges as the leader of Sturgeon's Scottish Nationalist Party. Some of the names who might throw their hats in the ring: John Swinney, Deputy First Minister; Hamza Youssef, Scottish Cabinet Secretary for Healthcare and Social Care. Kate Forbes, Cabinet Secretary for Finance and Economy. And Angus Robertson, Cabinet Secretary for the Constitution, External Affairs and Culture.
Successive Conservative governments here in London have said that the 2014 referendum was a once-in-a-generation decision and that it cannot be repeated anytime soon. In response, Nicola Sturgeon said she would turn the next Scottish elections into a de facto referendum to ramp up pressure on London to grant another vote. But without her in the driver's seat, it'll now be up to her successor to deliver what she promised. Saipur is up, London.
This is all they have to survive with for now. A little crumbling space filled with dirt and garbage. This Rohingya refugee camp on the outskirts of New Delhi is no more than an open prison for the members of the community who face constant threats and intimidation from law enforcement agencies. They say all their activities are being monitored and reported to the local police station on a daily basis. A member of the community is given that task, but that is not the only trouble. This woman says her son has been held in a detention center for months despite having a UN refugee card. With eyes full of tears and a numb voice, she revealed her ordeal.
My son was picked up by police along with his wife from outside our shanty 4 months ago. He did not commit any crime. He has been in a detention center for a long time now. I'm worried for him. The UN Refugee Agency says they are working on the case, but nothing has been done so far. He was working as a day laborer in nearby colonies. He did nothing wrong. I humbly urge for his release. We thank God that India gave us shelter, but there is constant fear of detention in the camp.
In recent weeks, the Delhi High Court ordered a joint inspection of the Rohingya Detention Center in New Delhi by officials of concerned agencies over the alleged lack of basic amenities. The court was hearing a plea of a female refugee who is facing bad health conditions due to the lack of basic facilities in the detention center.
My brother recently got married and he was detained just 3 days after his wedding along with his wife. Since then, he's in a detention center. My mother is blind and she cries every day for him. We have been living here for years and we are grateful to India for giving us refugees. I sell vegetables on the streets and similarly other men do menial work, but we are scared now since detention fear is looming across camps.
Most refugees here have heartbreaking tales of the past, and those memories of carnage and exodus are haunting them. Based on official estimates, India is home to some 40,000 Rohingya refugees, but independent reports put the figures at hundreds of thousands.
Most of the refugees I spoke with feared that their identity would be disclosed, given the high risk of detention. Scores have also gone into hiding at undisclosed locations across India. They have a horrific tales of separation from their families amid a persistent deportation campaign and an intensified crackdown against the community. Munawar Zaman, the outskirts of New Delhi.
Tehran has hosted the first disaster management conference titled Strong Iran. The three-day event has brought together different representatives and experts from various organizations which are responsible for managing natural disasters at the time of crisis. The event is aimed at training responsible organizations to have proper response to natural disasters. Meanwhile, Iran's interior minister addressing the event referred to the earthquakes in Iran, Turkey and Syria and said that the country should maintain its readiness more than ever before.
These events are a warning that we must maintain our preparation more than ever in the past, and dealing with natural disasters requires a modern and not a traditional approach, and the dimensions of these events must be controlled with the help of managerial, human, software, and equipment skills.
Iran has been a very disaster-prone country throughout its history. Earthquakes, floods, droughts, inversion effects of air pollution in metropolitans have occurred many times, affected millions of people, and have claimed hundreds of thousands of lives during the past century. According to the World Risk Report, Iran is among the countries with high vulnerability in the world. More than 80,000 people have died during the past 30 years in Iran, directly by natural disasters. The main objective of crisis management is to identify and prioritize crisis threats to formulate the best strategy for confronting the most immediate ones. Accordingly, holding such an event provides a good opportunity for officials and people to be prepared at the time of crisis. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Lives have been saved in Turkey following recent earthquakes because the country had access to heavy lifting machinery. Experts say many lives were lost in Syria because sanctions prevented the country from having similar equipment. The catastrophe has just been debated in the European Parliament.
Following the disaster, I contacted one of the largest aid agencies in Syria. I've spoken to Italian agencies and other NGOs. They all told me that the EU sanctions present an obstacle to humanitarian work.
European Commission officials told legislators that just 9 of the EU's 27 member states have supplied Syria with support. 21 have scrambled to help Turkey.
The Commission also allocated an additional 3.5 million euros in emergency humanitarian funding to help our partners address urgent needs in Syria.
This 3.5 million euro for Syrians pales into insignificance when compared to the 67 billion euro spent by the EU on Ukraine during the past 11 months. Experts have been saying for years that the bloc lacks unity when it comes to Syria.
Countries are acting in their own way. There is no coordinated action. And this is one of the reasons that we're faced with this very big crisis, this mega crisis.
Efforts by Western nations to overthrow President Bashar al-Assad have failed. Critics say interventionism has brought misery to millions of innocent people in the country. Some lawmakers want the pressure to be paused.
In Syria, there are sanctions. We don't want to see more people die in the cold. They don't have medicines. We must put politics aside and human life first.
It's been announced the EU will host a donors summit next month to gather money for the earthquake-hit regions. Political commentators are claiming it's already obvious that the vast majority of the money raised will go to Turkey, not Syria. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
I am visiting a children's hospital in Kabul, which is said to be overwhelmed with malnourished kids. Every few hours, a sick child is brought into the malnourishment ward, while doctors and nurses are racing against time to save the youngest victims of Afghanistan's crisis.
Unfortunately, this year, undernourished cases, especially severe acute malnutrition, have significantly surged compared to last year. Constant hunger and poverty and differing diseases are to blame for this, which puts us in dire need of more supplies and medical aid.
As you know, Afghans are gripped with poverty and economic problems. As a result, we are overwhelmed with a huge number of malnutrition. We are running out of bed and sometimes we are forced to reject new entries. Besides, childhood wasting as well as child mortality have also soared.
The World Health Organization says in 2023, around 17,000 Afghan babies and mothers are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition, while over 2.3 million children may suffer from moderate acute malnutrition. The UN body adds that an estimated 28.3 million people, which comprises two-thirds of Afghanistan's population, need urgent relief assistance.
We are a family of 10. My husband is a shoemaker. This malnourished child of mine is 3 months old. Two of my children died as a result of wasting and stunting.
Afghan people's miseries are growing day by day. Unemployment, poverty, and famine have gripped the society with poor lower and middle class households being hit hard. Many have brought their malnourished kids here, and I think it is because they have no food in their houses. We are calling on the global community not to ignore Afghans amid political and economic crises.
Concerns are on the rise among Afghans over their isolation from the international community and major cuts in global aid following the Taliban's takeover and U.S. withdrawal from their country. Afghanistan has one of the highest rates of malnutrition in the world. Afghans are calling on the global community not to leave them alone amid poverty and hunger. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Hundreds of people attended a national conference in Gaza, which was organized by Palestinian resistance factions. The event aims to bolster the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank. In recent weeks, extremist Israeli settlers and political figures, backed by regime forces, have been violating the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Israeli forces have also killed and injured dozens of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of 2023. Speaking to Press TV, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said the resistance in Gaza is ready to support the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank.
We will not leave the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank alone, and we will back them with all the necessary means. The occupying regime will not be able to divide the Palestinian resistance arenas. Last night, we witnessed unity in Gaza, Nablus, and Al-Quds.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces more than 55 years ago, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom.
Actually, Al-Quds is not just a word. It's something apart from our heart. So this conference asking and telling the world that this Israeli action against Al-Quds and West Bank must be stopped.
Palestinian resistance factions have expressed their unwavering support for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. They also vowed to use all forms of resistance to liberate Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank.
We believe that the Israeli government, under the leading of Netanyahu and Smotrich and Ben Gvir, going to raising up the aggressive against our people in West Bank, in Jerusalem, in Gaza also, maybe in other outside countries also. So we are going to resent the occupation by all kind of resistance.
Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank while turning a blind eye to violations committed by the Israeli regime against them for decades. Palestinians say that they will continue their struggle against the Israeli regime until the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing him. Terence fall low in awe of him. Faces are humbled in fear of him, and everything mighty yields to his mightiness. So to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then fail to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willest, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the situation of Palestinians would be much different today if Islamic countries had united and fought against the establishment of the Zionist entity from the very beginning. This is according to the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, during his speech commemorating the day when Prophet Muhammad became a prophet. in his address to Iranian officials as well as Islamic leaders from other countries. He said that enemies resorting to Iranophobia is because of Iran's outward support for the Palestinians. And the leader said Tehran will continue to support Palestine in any way possible and said that all Islamic countries have a responsibility to condemn Israeli atrocities and to be united with each other. Well, we're going to talk more about this situation overall dealing with the Palestinians. And first, I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Elijah McNear, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. And Fra Hughes, journalist, author, and activist out of Belfast. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off in Brussels. Tell me your overall perspective. I mean, when Ayatollah Khamenei used this occasion to mark the importance of the Palestinian cause for the Muslim world, your overall perspective on and why that was chosen and significance of it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.
The point of the Palestinian cause, it is the forgotten cause, because most the Arab nations are normalizing with Israel and the international community, including the Western community, is no longer advertising for the right cause of the Palestinians to return to their land and have their own state. So it is very important to always bring out the Palestinian cause because it represents the injustice that a large number of the population, the people of Palestine, are suffering. And because the West seems to be, claimed to be, very sensitive to human rights, and when we see nothing is happening, then we see other countries like in Iran, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, and a few other countries who are really concerned about the Palestinian cause and support the Palestinian cause. We see how the injustice is hitting the Palestinian cause in a place where they have absolutely no right. It is the only place in the world where Israel maintained a prison for the bodies, 375 bodies maintained by Israel. In the yearly annual report that I've seen only a week ago, when the Josep Borrell, the vice president of the EU Commission, acknowledged that there were 150 Palestinians, of which 33 children were killed last year, the report never mentioned anything about it. The UN condemned it. The US condemned the Israeli building of settlement, yet the settlements are built since 1948. There is no accountability whatsoever to the Israelis. This is why someone needs to remind the world about the right cause of the Palestinian, keep it in alive in the memory, particularly when we see the youth in Palestine are not forgetting and are claiming their territory back.
Well, Fra Hughes, you know, Iran has never hidden its support for the Palestinian and has paid a big price because of its support for the Palestinian cause. I mean, your overall analysis as a journalist of why do you think that Tehran has been so insistent and consistent with its support on Palestine since the beginning of the revolution, really, in 1979?
Hello, everyone. I think what we're maybe witnessing in Iran, that was a people's-led revolution, so we can assume that some of the policies that were absorbed into the Islamic Republic of Iran, not necessarily into the constitution, but into the fiber of society, into the body politics of what's happening on the ground, I think Iran is a bulwark against Zionism. If we look at Syria, I believe the main reason why Syria was attacked is because it is also a bulwark against Zionism, aggression and expansionism in West Asia. I think they were going for the domino effect of first we create ISIS, Daesh will destroy Syria, and then we'll either send in that army of mercenaries, murderers, and bloodthirsty psychopaths, either into the Caucasus or against Iran. So Iran has the moral high ground. The Iranian government, the people of the world, actually, I believe, the majority of the people of the world support the Palestinian people in their call for self-determination and sovereignty. but it is the Zionist supporting, Zionist leaning governments of these countries that refuse to acknowledge the plight and the suffering and the oppression of the Palestinian people under the apartheid Israeli military occupation. So people support Palestine, governments support Tel Aviv and Zionism. But I think the one place where you find, it's not just the one place, but one of the few places that you find the people and the government are walking in tandem on Palestine is Iran, is Yemen. It would have been Libya. It is Syria. It might have been Iraq, although more and more the Iraqi government seems to be standing up for Palestinian rights. And the crocodile tears and the hypocritical hand-wringing of the West about the continuing building of the illegal settlements, the continuing massacre of unarmed civilians in Palestine, in the occupied West Bank by the Israeli forces, just shows that the West has fallen into a morass of immorality and corrupt politics, and one of the few beacons of political morality, I believe, in the world is in West Asia, and it is Iran, and it is Syria, and it is the likes of Cuba and Venezuela and Nicaragua, governments and Yemen, governments where people stand up, where the governments stand up for their people. And that is the way politics should be. And Iran should have everyone's support as it stands firmly against Zionist aggression.
Okay, well, Elijah, how much do you think that Tehran's support for Palestinian has led to this Iran phobia or anti-Iran sentiments that we see?
This is one of the elements that the West uses to attack Iran, because it is a question of ideology for Iran to support Palestine and the Palestinians. It is also part of the Iranian constitution to support the oppressed people around the world. So anything that Iran is doing is criticized and the country is demonized, because Iran, first, is not submitted to the West. Secondly, it is claiming the right of the Palestinian, which is their legitimate right. And this is for the West. They see it as a danger to Israel expansion and existence. And Israel screams very loud by saying Iran wants to get rid of us, not acknowledging that they are really stealing the rights of the Palestinian, constructing settlement, misbehaving with the Palestinian, committing crime against humanity, against the UN Charter. So because of these elements, the behavior of Iran is called malign, because it doesn't fit with the Western mentality, it doesn't fit with the Western objectives. On the contrary, it contradicts it, because Iran is supporting the Palestinian, and supporting the Palestinian, like the Palestinian told us many times publicly, there are no limits and no conditions for what Iran is doing to the Palestinian, which means for the first time we see a genuine relationship where a country is not imposing its demand or its condition or its politics on another country or other people, the population, particularly in Gaza and the West Bank, without demanding anything in exchange. So the only objective is to free Palestine, and this is something that the West can't afford, because there's nothing is given for free. And that's why the model that Iran is offering is extremely dangerous for the West.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Frank Hughes, we saw during the recent World Cup how many Muslims sympathize with the Palestinian cause. However, most of their governments have been bullied or bought off basically into accepting Israel or turning a blind eye to the atrocities. Do you think that we're in the process of seeing a growing schism or separation between these Muslim nations and these rulers who have submitted to the Zionists, or your assessment of this whole situation?
I think there has always been that disconnect. I mean, I did mention earlier that I feel the people of the world as such support the Palestinians as an oppressed people who deserve the right to self-determination, yet it is the governments who support the Zionist apartheid state. It's exactly the same in West Asia. A lot of those, the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, if we go back to the Sykes-Picot Agreement and the redrawing of the borders in what they call the Middle East, I mean, all the problems created today stem from them. A lot of those countries, the Gulf monarchies, they send their soldiers and their generals to Sandhurst to be trained. They send their children to Oxford to be educated. They are all Anglophiles, and they see, this is the leaders of many of these countries, see more in common with the Western values of the likes of the United Kingdom and more and more and more with Israel than they do with the kind of Muslim Ummah that's spread throughout the region and across the world. I think there are 2 billion, would there be 2 billion Muslims in the world? That's an awful lot of people who support the Palestinians. And I think it's important that if we look at the fact that a lot of these places like Saudi Arabia, they're not democracies. You can't vote in the government. You can't vote out bad policies. You have to put up with the dictatorship of the monarchy. I think what we saw in Morocco, and indeed I was in Marrakesh on holiday during the World Cup, and I saw people come out with the Moroccan flags during Morocco's games that they played during the World Cup, and I saw people with the Palestinian flags celebrating too. So, you know, basically until they get rid of the dictators in West Asia, we will continue to have the schism between the people and the governments. And the problem is the people are unarmed and the governments are armed, and a lot of them will not hesitate to bring the troops out onto the street to repress any dissent within the nation. And we've seen people go to jail for 10, 20, 30 years for putting up a tweet about the about Mohammed bin Salman as the Saudi Arabian leader, people going to jail for a tweet. So while there is corruption and while these corrupt leaders move closer and closer to the other corrupt leaders like Netanyahu within the region, I see no real opportunities other than the axis of resistance to stand against Zionism and to stand up for Palestinian rights under international law.
Well, Elijah, we seem to be unfortunately witnessing a record year of Israeli atrocities against Palestinians in the occupied territory. Israel has also just approved 9 more settlements, which are all illegal under international law. Do you think this scenario would be the same if Muslim countries were united in standing up against the Israeli regime? And how likely, in your perspective, do you see this happening anytime soon?
It's very unlikely for the Arab countries and the Muslim countries to stop their contact and normalization with Israel, because they have chosen the path that is, as your guest rightly said, there's a huge gap between the population and the leaders. So the leaders are taking unpopular decision, and we've seen the reaction of the population. Therefore, as long as these leaders are not in connection with the people, they will insist on their position because they are more or less intimidated by the U.S. bullying. And the U.S. is the bully of the world, imposing its will on all the countries. Otherwise, they will wage war or impose sanctions to cripple the population and turn the population unhappy against their rulers. This is why it is very unlikely for these countries to stop the relationship with Israel and to impose on the Israelis to respect the right of the Palestinians. Moreover, on the other hand, I think that what is happening today is not negative, is not all bad. Having a very extreme right-wing government in Israel and having extreme measures by the Israelis is increasing the resistance, is making the voice louder among the Palestinians, making them more united. New groups are coming out. Youngsters between the age of 20 and 25 are responding to the Israeli aggression. They're rejecting it, including in the West Bank, those who were given Israeli identity, those who never known the PLO or the Democratic Palestinian Group or all the other different factions who started fighting the armed war against the Israelis in the 70s and in the 80s and in the 90s. So we are seeing a new generation, thanks to the behavior of the Arabs who tend to separate themselves from the Israeli cause, thanks to the radical behavior of the Israeli responsible, thanks to the extreme measures that the Israelis are pushing the Palestinians to the extreme, then there will be a reaction. And perhaps this reaction, if it increases and the Palestinians are united in Palestine, well, maybe the changes can happen. And that could influence on the Arab, like Qatar, who maintains some relationship with Israel. Nonetheless, it has a position where it is asking for the right of the Palestinians, which is better than nothing, although maintaining contact with the Israelis. On the other hand, we see the Saudis having good contact with the Israelis, but not declaring their normalization, and they have also meeting, etc., and without mentioning the Emirates, Bahrain, and other countries. So all this behavior of the Arab leaders is, in the eyes of the population, is shameful. In the eyes of the Palestinians, well, they know what we know what they think, but they voice it because they don't want to stop any possible support to the Palestinian population that is under the Israeli threat.
Right. Well, back to Belfast. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other Israeli leaders have said that Iran is Israel's main enemy. The significance of that, and why do you think that they continue to say that?
I'd say their main enemy for the Israelis is the people they're murdering on the West Bank and the people they have under an inhuman, unacceptable, illegal siege in Gaza. They will claim that Iran is their number one enemy because if you are Israeli, if you are the prime minister of that country, if you are a right-wing, right-leaning, fascist-thinking thug in the government in Israel, you're going to look around and say, who are our friends and who doesn't like us? And I believe Syria was attacked because it stands for Palestine. I believe Iran will constantly be under threat. We have heard recently of the American administration taking the MEK off the terrorist watch list, which implies that the CIA are potentially going to start arming them, which is where I would see that leading to. So Israel, as an apartheid Zionist state, sees Iran as the leader of the axis of resistance against Zionist apartheid expansionism in West Asia. It sees Iran as helping the people of Lebanon when they try to give them fuel, of helping the people of Gaza to break the siege, of standing side by side, shoulder to shoulder with the people of Syria in denying Daesh and Western hegemony the opportunity of destroying the Syrian Arab Republic. So you have a secular Arab Republic closely allied to a theocratic Shia Persian government. So what we have are they're not diametrically opposed, they're two separate systems that have come together in common humanity to help each other in the face of the regional aggressor, which is the Western-inspired colony of Israel.
What about that, Elijah? You just heard what Frost said, and I just want to pick up on that because he talked about the type of government that Iran has as opposed to Syria. And other, I mean, the main thing that the Western countries a lot of times and the Israelis talk about is Iran and sectarianism. And, of course, it's always trying to pit the Persians against the Arabs or the Turks. And isn't the situation actually what is happening with the Islamic Republic's support of the Palestinian cause actually an answer to all of that, that it has nothing to do with being a Shia or being a Persian or not being an Arab, but actually the resistance and being against oppression is actually key for Tehran over anything else?
This is a very good question. People don't read the Iranian constitution that forces Iran to support the oppressed people around the globe. And if we see the behavior of Iran supporting the Palestinians, who are majority Sunnis, supporting the Lebanese, Shia and Sunni, supporting the Syrian, who are majority Sunni, going to Iraq, and the first Iranian plane landed in Erbil in Kurdistan against ISIS, and not only in the Shia area, it has landed in Kurdistan. And Iran going to Venezuela, supporting the Venezuelan population that is oppressed by the Americans for so many years, it showed that Iran has a certain ideology that, notwithstanding all the pressure and all the sanctions, is really abiding by its ideology and abiding by its code, and is really fulfilling this code. Even if Iran is under harsh pressure, it is managing to create allies unconditionally. That is the key of success of Iran, and this is why Iran represents a serious danger to the West.
Okay.
It can't be accused of sectarianism because it's diversity of the support.
All right. I'd love to continue talking about this, but we're out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me. Elijah Magnier out of Brussels, Fran Hughes out of Belfast, both journalists. A pleasure talking to you. And with that, that brings us to the end of this Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new survey shows that half of the people in Canada are very angry about what they view as the country's mismanagement. In another survey, nearly 60% of Canadians said higher borrowing costs will take a toll. According to this poll, younger Canadians are more likely to feel financial squeeze. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted in this regard, over two-thirds of Canadians, 67%, believe their country is broken, according to poll results
published recently by the National Post, and Legger. Respondents across the political spectrum see a large divide between the issues they deal with in their daily lives and the issues their government chooses to focus on. Respondents were asked whether they agreed with Conservative Party leader Pierre Poilievre's claim that it feels like everything is broken in this country right now, though Poilievre's name was not mentioned. Just 25% disagreed with the statement, with the remainder undecided. Half of respondents reported feeling angry with the way Canada was being managed, with 2 out of 5 of those being very, very angry. Women were slightly more likely to be angry than men, and inhabitants of the Midwestern provinces, including Alberta, Manitoba, and Saskatchewan, were more upset than those on their coast. More than two-thirds, 68% of respondents named rising costs and inflation and interest rates as the primary issue affecting Canadians, with the state of healthcare also commanding 59% of the vote. Affording a place to live came third, named by 43% of respondents, and jobs and the economy rounded out the top four with 40%. This contrasts with where Canadians believe the federal government is focusing its energies. Just 28% see Ottawa concentrating, like them, on rising costs and inflation, while 27% said environment and climate change was the government's primary focus. Another 25% said the government was chiefly concerned with Canada's response to the Russia-Ukraine conflict, while only 14% of poll respondents listed the crisis as a significant issue affecting their own lives. Fully 22% of respondents confessed they had no idea what the federal government was prioritizing. Local government was seen as slightly more in touch, with 37% of poll respondents reporting their provincial leaders were most focused on healthcare, 28% on rising costs and inflation, and 27% on jobs and the economy. However, 17% of respondents said they did not know what their local government was prioritizing. Conducted late last month, the poll surveyed 1,555 Canadians randomly recruited from an online panel. Canadians are far from alone in their economic malaise. Recent polls show two-thirds of Americans believe their country is on the wrong track and the economy is widely considered to be the primary challenge facing the U.S. Meanwhile, Bloomberg reported a majority of Canadians say they will be squeezed if the Bank of Canada holds borrowing costs at the current 15-year high, pointing to an impending slowdown in consumption. Some 59% of Canadians expect to be negatively impacted if the central bank keeps its benchmark interest rate at about 4.5% this year, according to Nanos Research Group survey conducted for Bloomberg News. Another 14% see a positive effect, while 1 in 5 say there will be no impact. The data support the belief among policymakers that a pullback in consumer spending will drag economic growth to a crawl as heavily indebted households contend with higher mortgage and loan costs. Most analysts expect Canada to enter a technical recession at some point this year as interest payments crimp expenditures. watch out for Canadians tightening their grip on the spending wallet for 2023, Nick Nonos, founder of the firm, said by email, adding, even a holding pattern for the current rate will have some sort of negative impact on their personal finances. Inflation, however, is still a greater concern than higher interest rates. Nearly 85% of respondents said they are more worried about the elevated cost of everyday goods like food and gas than borrowing costs. Little changed from the middle of last year when annual price gains peaked at 8.1%. Younger consumers were more likely to feel pinched, with 67% of respondents aged 18 to 34 saying higher rates had a negative or somewhat negative effect. For those 55 and older, it's only 48%. According to Bloomberg, the Bank of Canada indicated last month it plans to hold borrowing costs and assess the lagged impact of one of the most aggressive increases to interest rates in its history. Policymakers say the pause is conditional on the economy and inflation evolving broadly in line with their forecasts, and warned of more hikes should the data surprise to the upside. In a separate survey, Statistics Canada said recently that one in four Canadians polled between October 21st and December 4th say they would be unable to cover an unexpected expense of $500 Canadian, that is $374 US, with more than a third reporting it was difficult for their households to meet financial needs over the last year.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.